Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Finn, and in the studio with me today is Joel Pascanner and John Masters, and you know what that means. It's our special edition Georgia Society of CPA episode. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
I am doing great.
Good morning, Kevin.
Anything new in your world? You guys are getting busy, getting ready for the tax season coming up?
Getting busy, gearing up. It's a little busy, but a little bit of a lull planning for the season.
Definitely. Getting your battle armor on.
We're getting pumped up. You know, it's a pregame ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And John and I were out there sort of fist pumping earlier.
Yeah, people trying to figure out how much they're going to owe come April 15th and next April 15th.
Definitely. Well, you guys are here to help inform them, make it a little easier, and tell us about some of the new stuff going on for 2013 taxes, aren't you?
Yeah, and I just want to spend a minute. I just want to thank the Georgia Society of CPAs. We've been doing this every other month, and we hope to continue doing it. We greatly appreciate this.
Well, we love having you guys, and we've heard some funny stories from you guys. You guys are probably the liveliest CPAs that we know.
Well, when you say tax, I think that's you think of fun.
Yeah, right. You know, get your green shades and let's go.
Yeah. I think what we were going to talk about, John and I, is we have both been doing year-end planning, and this is going to sound like shocking, but it's not. We're finding and expected to find that many individuals, owe tremendous amounts of money, lots of money for 2013. They will owe this. They're going to have a lot to pay in April with their tax returns or their extensions. Some of them had a good amount to pay with their fourth quarter estimate.
Yeah.
And if you recall, back in 2001, the Bush era tax cuts came into effect. And they lowered taxes in certain arenas, capital gains, dividends. And the way that managed to pass is over a 10-year period, there was a sort of a phase in, phase out. It had to pay for itself. Those 10 years expired. Certain things got extended. At the end of – I'm just giving you a quick recap.
Yeah,
at the end
definitely.
Of 12, it was sort of like that was the fiscal cliff. That was the doomsday.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? So a new act was passed, the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012. I think it was signed like the 1st or 2nd of January in 13. And on the one hand, it did extend some of these very favorable tax cuts. But on the other hand, as we're going to find out today, we've got some new taxes, and we got a lot more taxes to pay and a lot more taxes to address.
And it increased the rates.
All right.
Don't you think that was misnamed a little bit? The relief.
Yeah,
act?
But they always
like
seem to
life
do
insurance.
That.
If you buy life insurance, you live longer. Right?
Well, it's sort of like that one of 10, 12 years ago, or maybe I'm dating myself. The Paperwork Reduction Act. That was
that.
Does added that
like
ring
five
a bell?
Things of paperwork it, extra
that resulted in you know. Yeah, myriad numbers of paper reams, yeah.
Well, right.
So basically, the normal American probably isn't going to be expecting this, and it's going to show up on their taxes, and they haven't planned for it, right?
Well, I think people are expecting something, but they really don't know what to expect. They don't know how much it's going to impact them. That's really the issue I'm getting from people.
I'm curious because I'm sort of chorusing what John says, but I do think – I would have expected to get more of backlash is a strong word, but I've told them, I have been telling them they expect it, but I thought I would get a more adverse reaction. Now, I will say as of late in December doing some tax plans, I am getting people not realizing the full impact.
Yeah.
But I've heard all kinds of things, you know, that this might even be so significant in late March, early April, that it's going to result in a lot of selling, a lot of stock selling, bonds.
So it's really going to affect the economy. People are going to stop spending.
Yeah,
and
I don't know, and you know, but
I think it'll have that kind of impact. Whether it will be a big immediate impact is one thing, but it definitely just taking money away from one area and shifting it into another will create a change. You know, but it may not be dramatic at any given time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I just avoid, and I just hate when the taxpayer is getting touched. You know, it's like getting angry at the messenger. I just hate
that
scenario. Like, what am I, you know, how you am I going to get this money? You know, how, what do you expect me to, you know?
Well, see, what we do when people get refunds, we get them to come to the office. If they owe money, we send it in the mail.
Yeah, I gotcha. All right, that's a great business plan.
Return phone calls and
well, that's kind of, you know, I think more people are get anxious the closer it gets to April 15th. But some people are looking at it now. And
I think they are.
It's time to plan for 2014 as well as figure out where we are for 2013.
Oh, absolutely.
And 2013, let's kind of set the stage for 14 unless there's big changes this year.
No, I think you're right, and that'll get them into the groove.
Right.
I mean, I got a phone call yesterday. I did a projection for someone. I mean, granted, this person is a high ordinary income earner and made more money in 2013 than in the past, so normally you would think their taxes would go up.
Right.
But the wife emailed me and she said, I think your software is – I think you have a problem with your software. Is it possible that, you know, things haven't been programmed correctly because the guy's tax rate – I mean, his overall effective tax rate with Georgia was incredibly high. It was, you know, close to 50%.
Wow.
Now he has. We'll talk about some of these extra taxes. And the other thing with this particular person is they're a married couple, and for non-tax reasons, they're married filing separately, which exacerbates. That's the worst rate schedule for whatever reason, and that certainly exacerbated it. And I think the upshot is I think they're going to file jointly now because there's a tax savings despite the fact there's a huge tax increase. But I am getting feedback, discussion, explanations, you know, what's going on.
Well, that's kind of leads you to the question of, well, what can we do to reduce taxes?
Exactly.
Not much you can do about last year. There are a couple of things that can be done in some cases, but usually the idea going forward, people are used to thinking about increasing their deductions, but for a higher income taxpayer, that's really the wrong process. You need to be thinking about how you can reduce your taxable income.
Definitely.
Modified adjusted gross income.
Well, how would someone do that with their deductions for last year, and what can they plan for the upcoming year sort of to help them offset that?
Well, for last year, one of the few things you could still do to affect it is to set up if you're a self-employed individual, you could set up a retirement account still for yourself, and you could take a good deduction for that. That does reduce your taxable income for purposes of adjusted gross income and some of the extra tax calculations that you have to do now. But that's one of the few things that you can still do now to impact 2013 taxes.
All right, well, let's get into the nitty-gritty of it. What are the big changes? What do people need to be aware of for this upcoming tax season that they're not going to be aware of? Because you're saying that they're going to be
off. I think the big thing is what John, the biggest thing, there are a number of them, is this new tax rate. So they've added a tax rate basically for individuals with over $450,000 of adjusted gross income, 39.6%. So you're pushing 40%. The highest bracket was 35%.
Okay.
There are people, you know, high net worth individuals who do make $1, $2, $3, $4 million. So you're taking a good chunk of their income and you're subjecting them to tax at 5%.
Right.
I've got a guy who we do work for a number of attorneys at a couple of law firms, and their income is average, say, $2 million. So you have an individual, $2 million. He's having $1.5 million income now subjected to an extra 5%. That's about $75,000.
That's tough, especially if he's not planning for it, if he's been.
Well, you said, I think a lot of them, it's hitting him now.
Yeah.
This particular individual is one I'm thinking of is actually very tax savvy. And he came back to me. He said, my tax is going to go up, I figure, 90 to 100. And I think he was a little off. It was about $110,000. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Other taxes. So that, to me, is the biggest. I don't think there's anything you can do for 2013. Maybe for 2014 you have the ability to regulate, defer bonus income, and reduce, you know, get yourself below that level. That's possibly something you can do in the future. But I think that's the number one change.
I think the big point, too, is these people come to you guys and they act like you're magicians, and they'll come to you right before tax season and say, all right, make all my money disappear. And
well,
then,
we can do that.
And then they have to come up with this $75,000, $80,000, $100,000. Right. That's a lot of money. And if they haven't been planning for it, you can't just make that magically come out of thin air, even if you make $1.5 million a year.
It's a problem. As we talked before, communication's important. You intend to and attempt to communicate with your clients during the year, and you do. Yeah, the impact of this.
The surprise is the important thing.
Yeah,
but there are really three taxes that are increased. One is the basic rate, which Joel mentioned, and then you have two other items that are in there, and these apply only for income above a certain level, and that's one for 3.8%, which may be on your income above $250,000 or $400,000, or your investment income. So it can impact you there. The calculation can be complicated, but in essence, it's gonna, if you're earning more than $400,000 a year, you're gonna pay additional taxes if you have any investment income, which a lot of people do.
Definitely.
The other one is the 0.9% so-called Medicare tax, although as far as I can tell, it's not really, doesn't have anything to do with Medicare. It's just called that. It's going right into the general fund.
That's great. They just can make up names, and then they tax you for something, and you can go for whatever they want.
That's like the Unaffordable Care Act.
Yeah. Definitely.
You know, who figures? So anyway, those are the three basic rates. But along with the change that Joel mentioned, going back to the new law that was passed after the 10-year period that expired, they went back to the phase outs of deductions and exemptions. So not only is the tax rates themselves increased, but as you earn more income, your phase-out of deductions increase. So your effective tax rate is actually higher than the rate itself. When you look at what's the change in my taxes as a percentage, it'll actually change more than the sum of the changes in the tax rates.
Wow. So that's a lot of complex stuff. That's why I have to hire
you. It is all complex, and there are different, as John was mentioning, there's all these different thresholds.
If you make this certain amount,
it's very hard, and you got to run numbers.
It's messy.
It's messy. It's difficult. And basically, what Jean was saying is, your itemized deductions, you add them all up, and you get like a haircut. They're not going to give you 100%
of all your deductions.
We're going to give you a portion of it. Some of them are going to phase out.
Well, are they limiting itemized deductions also? Or,
well, yeah, this is.
Itemized deductions are limited in a variety of ways. Yeah. It's not even, you can't even answer a simple question with a straight, simple answer. But you've got phase out of medical expenses even before you get to the phase out I just mentioned.
Yeah.
And you've got elimination of part of the what's so-called miscellaneous itemized deductions before you get to the other. To the deductible amount. Then you've got the phase out based on your income. And then you have to go look at the alternative minimum tax and start all over again and see which one generates the highest taxes, and that's the one you get the privilege of paying.
It's very difficult because, like you'll talk with a client, I'll say, well, I gave $100,000 to charity, so you got that in there? And you go, yeah, I got that. Okay, so that's $100,000 times 39%. Okay, that's $39,000 right there, and then you got to attempt to explain to him. You know, like John said, first of all, that basket had certain limitations depending on where it went. And now there's this new thing, the total gets scaled down, and you tell them you only got a benefit of $20,000, $25,000.
That's going to be rough on the people doing it, like hearing that from you guys.
Well, the thing, I guess, in trying to simplify things, which is what I try to do, is to say, well, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to see through the maze of numbers and tell anybody what you expect the actual result to be without doing the calculations. And, of course, it couldn't be that complicated without computers, so we need to blame that on whoever that was from Georgia that invented the computer or something.
You know? Exactly.
Yeah. No, you're right. And, no, it's messy. And it's, you know, it's topical, and we anticipate, I just know we're projecting a lot of these taxpayers to owe significant amounts of money to the IRS in April.
So what can they do if they don't have this money? If they haven't been planning ahead, is there anything they can do to sort of offset it, pay it over time, or?
Well, actually, before you even come to that position, a thing to think about is what are the safe harbor provisions,
yes,
that is to avoid penalties, mm-hmm, and that kind of thing. So if you don't really know what your income is, and a lot of people don't know because they've sold businesses or they've got K-1s coming in from someplace and they won't get them for 2 or 3 months, then the safe harbor provision is if your taxes last year was under $150,000, I think, then you just pay in the amount of taxes you paid the previous year. If it was over 150, then you pay in 110% of that, and that will cover the safe harbor, so there'll be no penalties due for failure to pay inadequate estimated taxes. And then if you get a refund, okay. If you owe more money, a lot more money, then you won't have any penalties associated with it.
So what John is saying, and this is true, in most cases, because 2013's rates are higher than 2012's, most people were basing their 2013 tax payments, estimates, withholdings on the lower year, 2012. And there was an estimated payment date, I guess, yesterday. So that's what you're finding. You say, hey, let's keep yourself protected, but you're going to owe
more than
a boatload later on, potentially.
We're already too late for that, isn't it?
Yeah, we're too late.
Did I skip yesterday?
Well, there are some little tricks, I guess, you probably have up your sleeve.
Are we allowed to mention those on the radio?
I don't know when this is airing, but
it's airing right now.
But the 15th was the...
Was yesterday. Right.
But that's what's causing this problem. And and that is what most people have been advised to do.
That's scary stuff right now. Is there ever a time where it's more effective to be in a lower tax bracket? Like you're about to hit a new tax bracket, but you make sure you stay under that threshold, so you're not paying those higher taxes? Or,
well, I guess it's in effect, it's always better if you can make more money. Even your tax rate still won't be 100%, although there are probably some things you can connive where certain changes would effectively be more than that on a marginal basis. But generally, the idea is, you know, earn what you can, but try to figure out how to tax it as little as you can.
All right. So what advice would you give our listeners on what they should do right now to prepare for this tax season? I know you guys have already been giving a lot of advice.
One of the things you would just, dovetailing to your question, if you have I have a client, I may have mentioned this once before, who's going to reconfigure and reconstruct his stock portfolio.
Okay.
So usually when you do that, these investment guys like to sell everything. They sell stuff, they get commissions, that kind of stuff. But anyway, the idea is they're going to reconfigure this to make it a more effective portfolio for this individual, and it's going to result in capital gains. So we know
that's because they're selling securities.
Because they're selling securities, right? And they're appreciated at this moment. So what we do know is that this new 20% capital gains rate comes into effect when you get to that 450 level, which is that threshold for the higher bracket.
Yeah.
They say you're getting in that higher bracket, you're getting 20%. So we can say to him, you know, why don't you plan this thing out? Perhaps you can sort of calculate this thing and spread it out maybe over 2 years so he doesn't have a capital gain of more than such amount. Let's keep him under the 450.
Right.
And then the other thing John was mentioning before was the new tax on net investment income, which has a different threshold. It's lower. I think it's 250. You can maybe similarly, in the case I'm talking about or any other case, in terms of generating capital gains, certainly investment income, interest income, dividend income, try to stay below, play around with these thresholds so that you can save tax. So you get yourself into a lower tax, defer some, and futz around
over there. There's tips and tricks and stuff you can do to spread stuff out over time to make sure you're in a lower tax bracket, maybe even get some of your money that you're supposed to make in 2013, have them pay you at the beginning of 2014.
Yeah, like you said, get into 35, get into 15, and that's certainly doable, particularly if you start planning now?
One of the common things is if you've got a sale of something, then you maybe can sell it on an installment basis where you collect it in more than 1 year. So, breaking it down into 2 years
might save you $20,000, $40,000.
It could save you a considerable amount of money. And other cases, you're getting paid interest, hopefully, while you're collecting the note. And you might spread it out over 5 or 10 years, depending on your circumstances and what you need. And there are other things. These are not tricks. They're all in the tax code. They're nothing funky about them. But if you need the money, then you got to sell for cash. Well, you don't have that choice. So
yeah.
Not everyone can take advantage of it. And another one that I'll mention that's more complicated, and these won't apply to 2013. It's too late for that now. But for 2014, if you've got highly appreciated property where you'd have a big gain and a lot of tax if you sold it, you could set up a charitable trust, which those are fairly complex, but they're done. If there's a good bit of money at stake, then that's a good thing to do. And that effectively does some tax deferral currently, and it phases in the income over a longer period of time. So, and it does, charity will eventually, hopefully, get the benefit of what you've done. So there are things like that are out there.
Definitely. I'll be curious to see what Nest does after getting acquired by Google, what they do with their cash acquisition, the tax stuff they have to do with that.
Yeah, first, it's the Mercedes-Benz dealer or the Tesla dealer.
Yeah.
I would love a Tesla.
We all would. Those are techniques that you can use. This is sort of like a good, bad. I don't know if it's a good result, but you touched on it before, I think, Kevin.
Yeah.
The alternative minimum tax. Mm-hmm. So you still have this thing, this alternative minimum tax. You're still calculating your tax under two methodologies. You're going to pay tax on the highest one. And what we're going to find, again, this is generally speaking, you're always going to find some quirky results, is that because we have a new high tax rate under the regular regime, one would think we're going to find more people exiting, or not as many people potentially in the alternative minimum tax position, but moving over to the so the good thing, it's a good bit thing. The good thing is you're out of AMT, so that means you're getting the tax benefit of certain tax deductions you didn't get previously. But of course you're paying more tax. So
yeah.
It's a
sort of an ease of mind thing. Oh, I just have to pay this. I pay more, but I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, because you get a lot. I'm an AMT. Oh, I'm paying real estate tax. I don't get any benefit. Well, hey, you do get benefit. That's the good news. You're paying a lot more tax, on the other hand, but you're finally out of AMT, because they've always said, well, how do I get out of AMT?
Yeah.
Well, we always said more ordinary income. And, of course, we didn't foresee it. Let the government raise the tax rate.
And then they did.
That'll do it. They did it. You're out. Good news for you.
I've got good news and I got bad news.
Yeah.
Well, there's one danger that I would mention that I still see happen sometimes, and that is a lot of people with the larger companies have stock options and are various kinds of benefits like that as a method of compensation. And if you exercise those options and keep the stock, then that's income for the Altman tax purpose when you exercise the option, not when you sell the stock.
So you don't have the money in hand.
You have the money in hand when you sell it,
yes.
But you're subject to the tax for the Altman purposes. So you're paying. I said that wrong. When they exercise the option, they don't have the money.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
And they do have
the tax.
And you do get credit for it going forward. So when you actually sell the stock, you may get some credit for the tax you've already paid, but you may not get all of it. And if the stock goes down and you lose money, then you have the benefit of paying the tax with no actual benefit. So
that doesn't seem fair to me, especially since people that are going to have the option aren't going to have the money to pay the taxes as it is. They're going to lose a lot of money on that.
Well, that was a really big problem in 2000, 2001, 2002, and the decision finally was that we're not going to do anything about that.
Sounds like the government.
That was the congressional conclusion, and I don't remember reading any court cases about it, but I believe the.
I'm sure there were many.
Any ones that were there, they
especially
were,
if the market goes down over after they raise the taxes.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the classic right. example.
Yeah.
But
right.
you're talking like that's big numbers usually. These options,
right. yeah,
and they do have an impact.
But it's also true if you have regular stock options and you decide you want, you know, this is a good company I'm working for and I want to buy the stock and.
Well, if it's a middle management guy, he doesn't have the money to pay the taxes. It's going to force him to sell the stock.
Right. I had a client that did that with WorldCom.
Yeah.
Well, you know what happened to WorldCom?
I don't tell me, please.
It's not here anymore.
Well, it's not here anymore.
Oh, man.
You know, so yeah. they paid the tax to exercise the options, and yeah. then, you know, there was the problem.
That's
and
even more gambling than being in the stock market.
Stock went to zero. So anyway, if you're going to exercise a stock and hold it, then people just need to be aware that they've got the taxes to pay currently. And it's complicated to figure that later, but I mean you can do that. It's just a danger that I think people don't recognize.
Well, why? It's not logical. It's not. It doesn't fit into logic at all that you'd have to pay for something that you don't have income you haven't gotten yet. It makes more sense to sell the stock, pay for the money that you get from it, than all of that.
Well, it's sad to say, but sometimes I think some of the tricks are put in there intentionally.
Well, probably because they can't pay their own bills.
Yeah. Well, some people do a simultaneous thing, but if you want to hold the stock and get capital gain treatment, there is a phantom income element.
Right.
There's a higher risk to it, too. Because
absolutely. Yeah.
It's a dangerous yes. thing to do. So it's just people sure need to, it's like any risk. If you know what you're doing and understand it, then you decide to take the risk or not. But it's just there, and it's something that people often don't realize.
Yeah, I think that's the problem is that people don't understand the risk that they're taking.
Right.
So do you think if people were more informed that people would take less stock options and that might hurt companies that are trying to offer them as compensation packages?
I don't personally think so because all you got to do if the stock goes up, you exercise and sell and you make the money. And if they go down, well, you don't get anything.
Okay.
So it's still
just understanding the game.
It's understanding the game.
I think it's understanding the game because I do see at least one client considering, because as John has explained, the different ways these things are taxed and the different options, no pun intended, in handling these things, because there are there's two different types of options. And should we issue non-qualified options? Should we issue incentive stock options, which have this AMT effect? What are our guys going to do? There's a risk element. All these things we're talking about. So I don't think it's going to affect it, but it may come into play if they understand this as to the type of options, the vesting schedule, those types of things.
Definitely. Well, with all this information going around, how often should someone touch you guys, have a touch point, have a conversation with you guys throughout the year to make sure that they are on set and they can sort of have peace of mind going into tax season?
Does it depend
on the person?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be jumping in doing tax returns. We're going to have client contact with respect to the 2013 returns. One would think that's an opportune time. It always is. Find out what's going on for 2014, because if you're paying estimated taxes or even have withholdings, the first quarter is coming up and you need to address that. And then usually as you try to have a relationship with your client so that as the year progresses, they come to you and they speak to you. And also if there are estimated payments due periodically, you touch base with them. The whole thing is communication. Although I do, you know, they're like John said earlier, you don't want surprises, but there are some clients, maybe not the greatest communicators, and sometimes maybe not the greatest astute business people. And you find out, you know, something got sold, and like one of these partnerships or partnership interests got sold,
and they
don't know about it. But you know, you try to
educate
communicate and educate.
Well, yeah, a lot of people will not bother you with, and I say bother. That's not really the right word, but they won't call you unless something is changing, something's happening. And that's good, because if they do that, then you have an opportunity to look at what alternatives there might be and maybe choose a different tack than they might be thinking of. But if they wait till after the fact, then you know you're stuck with whatever the tax results are, and there really isn't much you can do except, well, what other things could we do maybe to reduce the impact? But with respect to that event, you know, it's already
just damage control at that point.
Right. So it's good to have people talk to you in advance. I had a client last year, maybe it was year before last, that when I learned that an event had occurred for them, well, I mean, it was disaster, you know, financially, you know, and in their case, unfortunately, they were victims of the, what do you call the Bernie Madoff process?
Ponzi scheme.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And basically, a broker just stole their money. Fortunately, he got caught quick enough till they got more than a minuscule amount of recovery, but it was still 20-30%, something like that.
Yeah.
Not as big as you would want. And I learned as a result of that, that there's a surprising amount of that that actually goes on. Surprised me. In fact, they sent me an article that was listing the 10 largest ones in 2013, I believe it was,
mm-hmm.
or 2012. And the one that they were the victim of was not even big enough to be mentioned.
Wow.
And I said, yeah. Gosh.
This is not.
I thought it was like once every few years something mm-hmm. like that might happen, but it really goes on a lot. So anyway, that I didn't know anything about it till it was after the fact. And then the question is, well, what can we do to recover? And the only thing further, I guess, I'd say about that is, because of the Madoff situation, there mm-hmm. are special yeah. rules that came down in IRS regulations about how to handle some of that, which differs from your typical, and I say typical, that differs from the regular tax treatment of some of those issues.
So it's just to help lessen the burden for
right.
them.
One thing I was going to, this is, I'm going to give an example, and this is really not a complete segue from what you're talking about, but I have an individual, and this is an individual who's really has pretty much slid through and even is sliding through now with the new tax changes. So this is a person who is very, very wealthy and inherited a lot of money,
yeah,
tens of millions of dollars. And he basically has, his tax return is very simple. He's got about $950,000 of municipal bond income. That's about all he's got. He has some expenses, but that income is not taxed on his personal tax return. He has a personal tax return with zero tax.
Wow.
So he gets $950,000. He lives on it. Now, he does pay real estate tax. He has a big house. Maybe it's $50,000. He does pay some state taxes because some of his bonds are non-Georgia. And his complaint is that he doesn't get a benefit for his deductions. He doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, what am I going to tell you? You don't pay any tax. Yeah, you didn't. You know, you don't have any tax income.
He's fortunate enough to be able to live exactly. off the municipal income,
yeah.
and that's really pretty cool,
right? So he's and so then his questions: well, how is he affected by any of this new stuff? Well, he's got no earned income, so the Medicare stuff
doesn't kick in,
and it turns out this municipal bond interest is not considered investment income for that 3. This we didn't touch. We touched on a little bit. John did
right.
the 3.8% tax. Which, if you have a lot of investment income, could be a sizable hit. So he's kind of slid through that, and
well, good see, for him.
Times are good.
See, we don't have.
I love these stories.
We don't have to worry about these kinds of people listening to the radio because they're Joel's clients. They're taking
yeah.
care of.
They're on a yacht right now. Just
yeah, they don't listen to this. But that's it sort of runs contrary to the. All the corollaries of
right.
what they were trying to AMT, and I'm not being critical, but muni bonds seem to big holders of muni bonds still seem to be doing very, very well.
Very well until they catch on. So until they get
well, it's the reason for that, of course, is that you're trying to foster investment in the community and in the states and so on. So they have favored tax treatment. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing on balance is mm-hmm. another story. But anyway, that's the reason for that. And in Georgia, your municipal bonds are exempt from Georgia tax, too, if they're Georgia. But Georgia doesn't exempt municipal bonds from South Carolina and
gotcha.
You know other states.
So what do you guys see the tax landscape going on forward to 2014, 2015? Is it going to get better? Are taxes going to get worse? What trends do you guys see going? Or is it going to level out and balance out?
Well, politically, I don't see anything getting passed. I mean, the Congress and the Senate and House are so such
loggerheads
that I don't really think there'd be too much happen with taxes. And this is an election year, so I don't really see anything much happening. Do you? I haven't heard of anything.
I agree with you. And I used to track, you know, these bills that would get proposed on a daily
basis.
Probably
got tiring.
I don't even do it. And I do have clients, and I guess I don't know how to – I'm truthful to them, that would say, I've heard about this bill, and it's this same guy. The munis are going to get included in that. And I say, I don't even follow
it
anymore.
Until it gets passed,
it don't. There's just such partisanship. It's very difficult to get anything. I don't see much. I think we're sort of locked into – these things at the moment. Most of these things are referred to as Obamacare changes. So when
that's a little scary right there.
When we explain them to clients, sort of deflects a little bit. It's called the Obamacare.
Well, one good point about some of this is that they had so much trouble with the Unaffordable Care Act that the penalties that would apply to the employers of 50 or more have been postponed for till 2015. So at the moment, even though there might be one that would be applicable, it's not going to be applicable for this year.
We could do a whole other show on how none of this can be paid for, but another show.
Yeah, but that's just with respect to the tax code. That's one of the things that has occurred.
Definitely.
You know, one other thing we could touch on, I think we may have touched on before, and John and I and some others were discussing yesterday, are these relatively new rules relating to same-sex marriages.
Yeah.
And you want to recap something? We were talking about this yesterday.
Well, the feds have basically said that same-sex marriage would be you'd have to file jointly or separately if you were married in a state that recognized that event. So Georgia hasn't adopted that, and so we have confusion over what to do in the state right now, which I guess that's normal. Actually, chaos is normal.
Chaos is normal.
Order is not,
it's not normal.
So when I say normal, I just mean it's messed up.
You're right.
So what to do in Georgia is not clear at this point. I think there are a lot of similarities with that issue and filing for a couple where the couple lives in different states. You know, this happens sometimes. So you're required to file jointly if you file federal jointly.
Yeah.
But in a state where one person is not a resident, well, then you have the issue of, well, how do you file there? So that issue remains in Georgia. And y'all were talking about some other things while I was in a sidebar, and
we were talking similar to things you're bringing up. Georgia's not the only state, but it appears that Georgia, I'm echoing what John said, is not going to allow joint filing, same-sex marriage partners to file a joint return.
So they're not going to save money.
So John's pointing out, that issue was not raised, the different states and different status. And if you're in one resident of a state that accepts same-sex marriage and one that doesn't, we were talking about similar things like that. How do you, it's clear you're going to have to split up a return. Georgia's not going to allow a same-sex couple to file jointly. So you're going to have to somehow pull this thing apart. And we were talking to you, I guess you follow the old rules. There are certain exemptions and exclusions you get together. Somebody was asking, do you split them in half? Well, the answer, probably not, because maybe you just file the way you used to file, which was single or head of household, and you get your own stuff. Just a lot of questions, and that's a great one.
That really is one.
Somebody said, I just heard it, but I don't know who said it, and I'm not sure what they were talking about exactly, was that someone had said, basically, do it the way you think you should, and we're not interested in looking at it.
Okay. Somebody said they had maybe it was an off-the-record conversation. I think it was with the commissioner or the commissioner's office. And at this point
of some state,
of some state that shall remain nameless.
I love that right there.
Yeah.
Cover our butts.
And he basically said, which is probably the right, you know, do it the way, in an equitable manner, the way you think you should do it.
Yeah.
I would assume there is, and I was trying to remember, I was going to bring it up yesterday, there is a state, I don't know which state it was, that actually came out with a worksheet. Now, again, it might be just, you know, character, you know, applicable to that state. But they came out with a worksheet and they said, here's how you're going to do this for us.
I see.
So it might be a good starting point. I don't know what state it was.
Yeah, I don't know. It's murky waters right there. And if anyone gets reprimanded for
one thing's important, though, with respect to the IRS, if you have a situation where you would be recognized for filing federal return as a married couple, then you have the option, actually, of going back and saying, well, I think I want to refile my prior 3 years' returns. And since you're going basically from two single returns to married to a married status.
Save a lot of money.
Well,
maybe.
Maybe, and maybe not. So you have to look at the numbers, but it is an opportunity, and it's one that people should probably look at. You probably have the same result. That is, if you have one that's working and one that isn't, then you would save taxes going from single to married filing jointly. But if you have two spouses working, both making essentially the same amount of money, then the probability is you probably won't save money. Well, okay. you would save money, but you know, with a change back to this year, I hadn't really looked at that closely.
I haven't looked at it, and what John's talking about is we're just moving on from topic to topic, is the marriage penalty.
Yeah.
Right.
There are situations, and I haven't looked at it recently, there are situations where you have two people working who will make maybe a substantial good salary, where there's been, the way the calculations have worked out, it would have been cheaper for them to
file singly.
Well, when they changed that back a while back, it made it where if you were single and you made the same amount of money, then it basically turned out to be the same tax.
Yeah.
But whenever you have a difference, one's making substantially more than the other one, then filing separately will always cost you more money.
Absolutely. And I have one now, too. I mean, this all comes into play. I have a woman who makes a nice salary. She's a professor at a university here. Makes a six-figure salary, and she just got married to a guy who also makes a six-figure salary, and which
and
is good. The communication, I mean, she came to, which is a good thing. She said, "Hey, I got married." I said, "Yeah, I heard that." And she said, "I'm filing separate. There are some other non-tax reasons I'm filing separate." And I told her it may cost more and this and that. And she just gave me the other guy's return. We're going to look at it, but you're going to run the numbers. And see
what's best.
I mean, that also speaks somewhat to the fact that the people living together that aren't married anymore is going up as a percentage of the population. And, you know, that may have something to do with it. You know, people are finally catching on.
Well, if you remember, and this is going way back, but I think in the 80s when this thing became very well known and publicized that it would be cheaper in certain circumstances than not file jointly. I think there were certain junkets that were put together where you could go. You fly in someplace on the 31st because your filing status is determined on the last day of the year. And you get divorced, and then they remarry you the next day. Remember these junkets?
Imagine explaining that to your wife. Here's what we're going to do, honey.
Well, yeah, listen, I got a great idea.
Listen, you know, usually your spouse ought to be interested in anything that saves money, right?
Well, exactly.
So, you would think
it was real interesting, and it's still interesting today. The deal was people were flying to Mexico. Well, when the IRS said, "No, this can't work," you know, I mean, this ain't right. Well, what's right got to do with anything?
Well, anyway, it's all about
it comes to taxes, but I mean, so. Anyway, they go to court with it, and basically the court decision said, well, the U.S. doesn't recognize Mexican divorces, so you can't go to Mexico and get a divorce and come back to the U.S. and get married again and do this because we don't recognize the Mexican divorce. So the moral of the story wasn't that you couldn't do what
you're right.
What they said, it was that you couldn't go to Mexico
and do it.
Yeah.
To do it. And, of course, there may
and, of course, you couldn't do it in other – there were other Caribbean countries.
Right.
And the problem was I think it was a story on 60 Minutes, which sort of brought it to a head immediately. And
well, people are very inventive, you know.
Exactly. When it comes to saving money, they'll do anything.
You know, you can get an extension that way.
That's what I was just thinking too. Yeah. You have to be out
if
of
you the... if you just can't file your return on time, get a ticket to Aruba or Cancun or somewhere out of the country, and then you get another 20 days,
something like that. I, being from New York, I do remember, and this is a ways back, but I do remember somebody actually telling me they were driving to Canada. They were going to drive from New York up across to Niagara Falls. I'm going over the border for the day, and I got to get more time, something like that. I mean, well,
I love it.
It keeps you legal. There's nothing wrong mm-hmm. with it. And if you just can't get it done on time, that's
so many different loopholes.
And that's a thing to do.
There was.
It's all in the good book.
Yeah, it's all there. It's all legal.
It's. There are things you can do, yeah.
Definitely. All right, so earlier we were talking about same-sex marriage, and that's recognized federally, but some states are the murky water. What about the opposite? In Colorado, legalizing pot, there's people making money off that, not recognized federally.
You asked that question.
Is there any? I'm just curious on the other side of that.
Well, a little bit we can talk about actually another member of the Georgia Society, and I have an article that will be in the current accounts about working for people who yes. are in the production mm-hmm. of marijuana, because it came up as an ethical issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we hadn't really thought about it before, but hey, what do we do? And so we concluded, just without going through all the detail, that if you're doing compliance work, that is filing tax returns and doing the accounting for them, where you maybe have assurance services and stuff. I mean, some of these companies are now listed on the pink sheets, or some of the mm-hmm. public traded companies on the exchanges are engaging in that. Then you're okay. You know, you don't have any ethical issue with providing those kind of services, but it's unclear, actually, to us whether or not you could be in the business if you're a CPA without violating the Code of Professional Conduct, because the Fed, still, it's a federal crime.
Exactly.
And even though the bulletin that came out in August says that they're not going to prosecute anybody who's doing what they're doing inside a state where the state authorizes it, is still in violation of federal law. And
so they definitely
could. In violation of if it could result in a felony, then that is a violation of the AICPA, American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, professional ethics. And I haven't been smoking either. So that's kind of the conclusion that we drew, that if you're in the business of marijuana, then you'd have a problem with the AICPA Code of Professional Ethics, which in turn would mean...
So do you have to pay federal taxes then? You're like, well, we're already doing something wrong.
Well, if paying taxes, you have to pay taxes
on any income.
And that's part of the economy, on any income, and it's still...
But I was speaking toward if you were going to be in the business, go to Colorado, go in the business. If you're a CPA, you might have a problem with that ethically. Or if you're in the consulting business and you're trying to tell them how to expand their business, I don't know that they need any guidance.
It's a normal business.
But if you're trying to promoting the business and trying to aid in the sale of it, then that is punishable under the CSA. What does that stand for? The federal law.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a felony, or could be a felony. So aiding in the promotion of the business would be a different thing, and probably something that CPAs should think seriously about getting into.
I would think it's somewhat, and I don't know. You seem to be somewhat more knowledgeable on this than me.
I know about some of the rules on it.
Yeah, I'm not inferring that. That's what we're talking about. but what I'm thinking of
in 1910.
What I'm thinking, that's an inside joke, but what I'm thinking of is like prostitution is legal in certain parts
of California.
I was going to say Nevada, but
Nevada. That's okay, what I meant.
Okay.
That's what
I meant. No, you, again, you may be more knowledgeable in that area.
It is,
but
Nevada,
and gambling is certain is so. Maybe is it maybe those rules are somewhat similar.
That's a good analogy.
I don't
and
know.
One that we didn't look at the gambling aspect of it, but I don't think that's a violation of federal law. And what we're talking
Nevada,
about,
though, I think the Bunny Ranch. I think that is though.
Well, I would think that would be
Mustang Ranch.
Oh, the Mustang Ranch is a Bunny Ranch. Yeah.
Did you know the IRS owned that at one time? They repoed
it. Did they?
Yeah.
Did they take turns? Oh, I'm going to go audit this.
I don't know how they collected their money down there. But.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting question, and we hadn't fully ferreted out the rules on that, but. That's an interesting.
I was just curious about that, but it's a gray area there that they can turn a blind eye to. But whenever they want to, they could come back and just nail anyone for anything.
Well, my actual concern about that is that a change in administration may have a different view on it, and not to address the pros and the cons of the idea itself. It's just the political situation would. Say to me, be careful about doing that.
Well, it's a hot topic, so someone could try to come in, get elected, and on one of that as being their main topic is that's not right. We're going to get rid of that.
It is a hot topic. I asked one of the state legislators if he expected anything to be introduced in this session of the legislature about legalizing marijuana or anything, and he just laughed. So I assume the answer to that was no. Mm. But several of the surrounding states. Do have proposals in there to legalize medical marijuana or some form of it like that.
Definitely. Well, that'll be something to look out for in the years to come and see what happens. And we'll probably talk about that next year. Next year, something will happen in that arena. Well, before we wrap up, guys, you guys have anything else to say? Any other great stories or anything we didn't touch on?
I don't have any other great stories, do you?
I don't have any great. Well, I probably do, but
I love your stories. So
you love stories, true to life stories.
Well, the one thing that I'll mention, there's a change, and I haven't read these yet, to the ability to get a late election approved for the sub S election. A lot of people have trouble with the sub S election.
Yeah,
everybody's got trouble for that for some reason.
They mean to get the sub. They don't file a 2550. What is it?
2553. Hear about these all day. Everybody's got a problem.
Right.
With that. Yeah.
And so then they wind up thinking they're being treated. Or their lawyer was going to do it or whatever. And so there's been a lot of problems with that. And so there have been a number of IRS rulings come out saying you could. Get it if you did this, you could get it if you did that. And then if you didn't do those, well, then it cost like $9,000 for an IRS letter ruling to get to apply for it.
Wow.
So now they've changed that so that it's a more friendly environment if you make a mistake on your S election. So anyway, just an interesting tidbit that's out there.
That's good to know.
Very nice.
Good to know. For some reason, that happens all the time, yeah.
Well, then let's get your contact information so people can reach out to you and get your services. And what's also the website for the Georgia Society of CPAs?
You want to go first?
Georgia Society of CPAs website is gscpa.org.
Simple.
Mm-hmm. Very simple. And that'll take you to the website. And my name's John Masters. I'm a CPA and a lawyer, and I practice in the Buckhead area and have been in Georgia for most of my life, not all of it yet. And my website is johnmasterscpa.com.
All right. Joel?
And I am Joel Pascanner. I also practice in the Buckhead area. And our website is BermanLLC.com, and my email address is jpascanner@BermanLLC.com.
Well, guys, as usual, it's always a pleasure having you guys in the studio. Always get great stories and great information. This is Kevin Finn for Joel Pascanner and John Masters and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.